Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Tana Reeb Du. She is the author of The Wishing Pool and Other Stories, her latest short story collection published by Akashic Books. She is an award-winning author who teaches Black horror and Afrofuturism at UCLA. Her stories have been featured on LeVar Burton, Reads and Realm, and she is an executive producer on Shudder's documentary, Horror Noir, A History of Black Horror. A leading voice in Black speculative fiction for more than 20 years, Du has won an American Book Award, an NAACP Image Award, and a British Fantasy Award. And welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be back. Good to have another book out.
Well, it's good to be scared and reading a book. And I will tell you, when I was reading The Rumpus Room, and the way you sort of, the way you built up that concern and what was going to happen to that character, and you know, and it got so bad, I was reading it in the morning around a lot of people. I was at a coffee shop, I'm reading through the story, and I was still scared. So tell me this, when you're writing these horror stories, are you thinking to build up the fright that we're all kind of looking for? Are you writing thinking this is something they're going to be reading at night with the door closed in their bedroom or their favorite lazy boy lounger? Or you're thinking, I'm going to really amp up the fear here. So no matter where they are, no matter how many people are around, no matter what time of the day, they will be getting scared.
Well, listen, all of the above, really. There are so many ways to answer that. First, just as a lover of horror myself, I love that experience when you're reading something. Like, I remember reading a story called The Devil in America. It's a novelette that's actually free on tor.com, The Devil in America by Kaya Shanti Wilson. And I was getting so scared that when a twig brushed against the back of my neck, well, you know what happened next. I was like, probably screamed. But that's a tough thing. You can get a jump scare in a movie, but scaring people with words is, I think, a little bit tougher than scaring people on film. And the way I try to do that is, number one, scaring myself. That has to be where it begins and ends. In fact, I really can't think too much about the reader at that point, because every story I write is deeply, deeply personal. And even though Rumpus Room is one of my new stories, it's also a novelette because it turned out to just be so long. And if it's longer than a short story, they call it a novelette. That one had a lot of, it wasn't based on a true story, but there's just enough of my real life in there. Like, I grew up on the bank of a canal, like the canal I describe in the story, in Southern Florida, not the $1 million homes part, but the canal part. And there was a fungus growing in my shower. That's literally where the story came from, is that one day I was in the shower and I'm nearsighted, so I didn't have my glasses on. And I noticed a brown spot in the corner that I thought was a washcloth that had fallen. So I nudged it with my foot, but it was hard. And I was like, what the heck is that? And when I put my glasses on, it was this pretty large fungus. And I'm like, where did this come from? How did nobody see this? Can this like grow overnight? I was just so shocked. I didn't even know we had an opening in the tile big enough to let this. And it was like, I took pictures, I did research. It was disgusting. It was disgusting. So that sat with me for a while, like probably a few weeks, where I was trying to figure out, okay, I want to turn this real life fright of like when my foot touched this thing, and I want to express that in a short story. And I came up with a character who was both in grief because she separated from her daughter. I don't think that's too much of a spoiler, but who has also committed a transgression. Those are my two doorways to horror: grief and or transgression. And in this story, I gave her both the grief and the transgression. So that to me is, I think, what we get from horror as readers, is that we already feel grief. We already feel fear. And usually the things that we feel fear about are too big to just think about all day, or we'd never get out of bed. So horror stories help us tap into just a piece of it. Like that show, This Is Us, that show would have me crying every week over these imaginary people. Because the grief is right there. It's right under the surface. And it's safer to express it through these fictional people than it feels to really sit with what's really hurting.
Well, I love the way that you built out the character of Katrina, Kat, because it wasn't just, I'm going to scare you type of writing. It was also, let me tell you what she is personally dealing with, some of the issues that she has. And so when you were creating that character, was that there from the very beginning? Were you really looking to build out the character that much in this particular short story?
In this story, oddly enough, the character came last. You know, the fungus was the first thing. I had an idea of what I wanted the fungus to represent. I'm not going to go into it. And I had an idea of the kind of journey I would want a character to have. But it would not pop to life until I had Kat. And I wanted to create a protagonist different from some of the other ones I've created. She's at an age that I don't write about that often, like her early 20s, you know. I write a lot of children. I've written some older characters, but that like early 20s age, I don't do a lot with that space. So I wanted to make her like a fresh feeling character, a character who is in a precarious financial situation. So she has to rely on the kindness of strangers, as they say. When I figured out, but the thing was her transgression, and I'm not going to go into what it is, although it is the first line of the story. But that transgression is what really brought her to life for me, because I am also a parent, and all parents look back across the time they spent with their kids when they were younger, and they're like, oh, I was not at my best on that day. Now, I have never had a day like Kat. You know, what you do in horror is you exaggerate it. You right. exaggerate that feeling of guilt that we feel at parents for like either that meeting we missed or that recital we missed or that time we snapped or shouted and we shouldn't have or whatever it is, all those things you wish you could take back. So I amplify that up to something horrific and wanted to see where that would take the story.
Well, let me talk about another one of the stories that caught my attention. So I can recall listening, not reading first, but listening to The Monkey's Paw.
Okay.
That story where you get the monkey's paw and you get the three wishes. And so we got the wishing pool. And, you know, I think a lot of people know about, you know, wishing and, you know, you're thinking about how I wish this could be different. But we never really think long and hard about how our lives could be different, how things could be different if you make a wish.
And if it comes true.
Exactly. So The Wishing Pool, was that a story you created for this collection, or was that a story that had already existed?
That story had already existed. I believe it came out a couple years ago. It was on LeVar Burton Reads. And because LeVar Burton Reads picked it up so quickly, I thought, if I do another collection, maybe that's what I would call it. Although in fairness, I really did want to call it Rumpus Room. But the editors were like, they, you know, sometimes editors have like a reaction to a word like rumpus. That's not working for me. But anyway, The Wishing Pool is another deeply personal story. In fact, more personal even than The Rumpus Room, because I do have a mother who passed away. I do have a father who's 88 years old and who struggles with memory. So I wrote that story right after COVID. It was, I had made plans to see my father for the first time in about a year and a half after COVID and did not know, you know, what condition I'd find him in. He lives with my sister. I know he's well cared for, but how would our relationship have changed after so much time away? I was very worried about it. So I took that fear very literally and put it into a story with a, you know, I exaggerated the living conditions. My dad's not living in a cabin. He's actually living in a two-story house with an elevator with my sister. But what if he was living in a cabin? What if you're watching your whole life, like your whole history just crumble away before your eyes, kind of like this man, her father is experiencing, watching his life just sort of crumble away before his eyes because he's losing memories. And my father used to take these notepads and like write down things to remember, his passwords, his birth date, his, you know, just things that you want to make sure you don't forget. We all do it, But as we get older and we struggle with memory, it becomes even more important, right? So that's where that story came from. This notion of me trying to make peace with whatever I would find when I went to see my dad. And what I like to say is, it may not feel like the happiest ending for the protagonist, but it might be a happy ending for the father.
Absolutely. I don't.
And
I,
it ain't about us, is it?
But that's not how we think. No. We tend to think about ourselves first.
Right. I mean, so, he seems okay to me, but she's not going to be that okay.
So you talked about being inspired for a lot of these stories about things that have happened in your life. When you're writing about family situations, is that something that you think, okay, let me run this by family first?
Maybe I should. But, you know, there's this principle called asking forgiveness rather than permission. And I have been guilty in the past about writing stories. Like, even in my previous collection, Ghost Summer, I wrote a story called Trial Day that was very literally based on family history from the 1920s that my mother did not want me to write about in our memoir. My mother and I wrote a civil rights memoir together called Freedom in the Family, a mother-daughter memoir of the fight for civil rights. And she said she didn't want that story in there. And I was like, what? Some years went by. And I fictionalized the story and I put it in my collection because for me, of course, you want to be respectful to family members. And this is especially important because I have a novel coming out in October called The Reformatory that is inspired by a real life relative, my great uncle, who died at the Dozier School for Boys in Marianna, Florida. I did not know him. And my research process was not about him, because really, it was almost like a family secret that this happened. But I do feel like at a certain point, within the bounds of being respectful, all of us as artists have experienced these things. So with Trial Day, that story in the other collection, this was something that had such an impact on my family that it was still reverberating for generations. And I felt like I needed, as someone who's in that family, who's someone who's breathing that same air, that started from what happened in 1920, because that's how intergenerational trauma works, that it is not only my right, but my responsibility to engage with that trauma in a way that feels healing for me, but hopefully not hurting other people.
Well, I think that's interesting because I think I know from experience there are family secrets.
Yes.
Just aren't talked about, or maybe they're sort of casually mentioned among the adults, but they really don't share that story. And I remember reading this book, The 12 Tribes of Hattie. Mm. And what struck me, and this book went over, this was a novel that went over multiple generations, started, I believe, in the 1920s, goes into the 1970s. One of the things that struck me that was one of the core things of this book was how parents don't realize the things that they do that they think their kids don't know about, how it can traumatize them without them even knowing.
No, exactly right. And that's, I think I engage with that to a degree in Rumpus Room, because that story is also about intergenerational trauma. But like the way I like to put it is, and very often it's about sexual assault, sexual abuse, incest. That's the kind of stuff nobody wants to talk about. Like, I have a friend whose mother won't even tell her who her father was because we suspect there was some sort of a coercive situation and she's too traumatized by it or whatever. But the thing is, they think they're protecting us, right? They think, or we as parents think we're protecting our kids when we don't tell these stories, but at the same time, they shaped us and it's still sitting at the table. Even if you don't talk about it, it's still sitting at the table. Like, my late mother did not like to be touched. And I don't know all the stories behind that, but she tried to go out of her way to be loving and touching and huggy as a parent. But I think I still inherited a little bit of that. You know, I'm not so huggy. So I don't know. I don't even know where it came from, but I still inherited a piece of it. And I think that's what we need to be mindful of. I mean, yeah, some stories are not meant for the ears of children, but after our children grow up, maybe some of those stories do need to be aired so that we don't repeat history and so that we understand, oh, that's why you couldn't mention that word around dad, or oh, that's why he would flinch or she would flinch.
Thursday night shift. I'm going to let you describe it because I don't want to spoil anything. But that I love Thursday night shift.
I'm really happy. That story was originally published in a paper publication. And I didn't even realize at the time, oh, that means that I can't tweet it out to people, you know, like you can't circulate it the same way as when it's a digital publication. So I was so happy to be able to include it in this collection. This again is about repairing not just what feels like personal loss, but a national, even international loss through Afrofuturism. So I describe Afrofuturism as the speculative arts of the African diaspora. It's not always about the future. Sometimes it's about the past. And this story is set in the past. I like to write historical horror. It starts with a relatively mundane family in Memphis. You know, the woman is getting ready to go to work with her job as a housekeeper at a motel. And as the story unfolds, you realize which motel it is and you realize what day it is in 1968. And this question of what might happen if we had the power to change history. And I'm gonna leave it at that.
Wow. I tell you that it surprised me. I want to do a little shift here. So we have some plague stories. Yes. So I'm gonna jump to the conclusion. I'm sure everybody that interviews you jumps to the conclusion of, were the plague stories inspired by COVID, or was this something already percolating prior to COVID?
It was prior to COVID. There's only one plague story I wrote post-COVID, and that was the very last story, which is called The Biographer. And even in that story, the plague is mostly over. So the Naima stories, which are the primary plague stories, started many years ago. I forget when they were first published. Might have been 2014. In fact, it had to be before my first short story collection because I had Naima stories in my first short story collection. So those stories were inspired by a series of books that were supposed to be about the end of the world. And every writer had the freedom to choose what the end of the world looks like to them. So one story was supposed to be right before the end of the world. One is during the end of the world. And one is after the end of the world. And I loved the character I created. I decided to use a recurring character for all the stories at different stages of her life. So even in The Wishing Pool, when we meet Naima, the plague is still alive and well. It's fairly early stages of the plague. But she wants to do a stand-up comedy routine. Because I figure she's...
Oh, by the way, I got to... That's wow. In the middle of a plague. And look, Pacific Coast Highway. And it's almost a cemetery. You built a little car cemetery. And the craziest thing is, when the plague hits, everybody wants to go to Malibu.
Well, again, we vacationed in Malibu, so I'm never going to waste an experience.
My daughter wants to go to Pepperdine. Can you guess why?
Well, yeah. I mean, we did our first Airbnb was in Malibu. So I can't afford to spend that kind of money and not use it somewhere. So that setting stuck out for me. Because even pre-plague, I mean, Malibu, I don't know. It just wasn't what I thought. You know, it wasn't Santa Monica Pier, like vibrant and full of life kind of feeling I was expecting. So for me, I just exaggerated that into the plague situation. But my go-tos during COVID were horror and comedy. So I think that this is a story where I kind of blended them together. I wish the jokes were funnier. My editor didn't think the jokes were funny. I mean, maybe I could have punched them up. But the point is, she's not a comedian. She's just a regular person who has survived this plague. And she's, by the way, immune. And she's keeping that secret because immune folks are a whole different category. Sometimes they're not treated well, let's just say. And the second plague story in her world, which is called Attachment Disorder, is about the same character in her 60s. You know, she's been through a lot since we saw her doing her stand-up comedy show. In fact, that story, One Day Only, that might be the last best day of her life, is that story. And it ain't that great a day. Okay, so that'll just tell you what kind of situation they're living in. But that is a peak day for her. And then she, you know, by the time she's in her 60s, we see a little bit of what's happened to her since, to the point where she doesn't even believe she can trust a human relationship as primal as a mother-daughter relationship. I mean, okay, her daughter was gestated in an artificial womb, but still, it's her daughter. So
what happened to Karen? I'm like, where's Karen?
Karen. Oh yeah, Karen. Let's just say that relationship did not sustain.
Clearly she had some doubts about that relationship. And another story that just really was a curveball trying to figure it out at the very beginning was the story where the young woman you deal a lot with smell in this story, and she's just hating the smell of her boyfriend. It's her fiance. They're going to get married, and she's just hating him. But at some point, she really loved him. Yeah, a true love-hate relationship, which I will let you sort of describe, because I don't want to do any spoilers here.
That story is called Migration, and I don't think it's too much of a spoiler. You know, I don't write many stories from the point of view of people who are truly monstrous. And that was kind of an exercise in what would it be like if you woke up and you realized that little exorcism your grandmother tried to do on you when you were a little girl maybe didn't take. That's basically the premise of that story.
Well, I tell you, her poor boyfriend, I'll get help for you. I'll get you some help. Just stay right here. Let me make a call for you.
He has no idea what he's dealing with. And she's making up excuses like she had an Ambien. No, honey, it is not Ambien. Overdose on Ambien.
I'm like, dude, can't you see this?
But people don't know how to deal with possession. Nobody's ever seen the possession. It's, you know, that's one of the Gracetown stories. Gracetown is an imaginary setting I started writing
about. Now, you grew up in Florida, so let's,
grew up in Florida now, but of course, I grew up in Miami. And Miami is a whole different animal. And I don't really write that much about Miami. Yeah, I kind of fixated on Northern Florida, which is where my mother was from. They bought a house there a few years before my mother passed away. So I got the chance to see where she grew up. And I was just fascinated by the red clay soil, and they had woods abutting the gate. I wrote all kinds of stories about those woods in my last collection. And I just decided to fictionalize Quincy, Florida as Gracetown, which is a place a lot like where we live in the real world, but where magic is just real. So whether it's ghosts, if there's anywhere you're going to see ghosts, it's going to be in Gracetown. And the people most likely to see ghosts are children. They are the ones who usually come in contact with the uncanny. But as you see, as you read the Gracetown stories, it's not just children who get affected by the uncanny in Gracetown. And it's not just ghosts that you will see in Gracetown either.
Well, I think there's a not so subtle message that if you were lost, don't go knocking on doors, especially if that house looks pretty dilapidated.
Listen, that was based, again, real life.
Yes.
Real life. After my mother passed away, I didn't even change that part. My husband and I were on our way to a friend's house for the gathering after the funeral, the repast. And we were on this 2-lane road in Northern Florida. We had no idea where we were. The navigator just says, good luck at that point when you're out in the boonies. The navigator is no help, whatever. And we finally came across some civilization. We saw a paved driveway, and there were these three houses like living on the same parcel. Now that's called a compound. And we weren't thinking compound. We were just like, oh, here's a driveway. And as we're driving up the driveway, we notice a big old flagpole and a Confederate flag flying high over this compound. And we were like, oh, hell no. And we backed up and we changed our minds. So I took it, rather than making it a compound, I just made it one dilapidated shack. And instead of having a huge, because sometimes when you try to replicate reality in fiction, it feels like too much. And I feel like in that story, it would have been too much to have what we saw, which was a big flagpole and a Confederate flag. It's too obvious. It's too over the top, on the nose, So I made it a little faded bumper sticker on the back of a truck, but that's enough. That's a signal. And there's an interesting backstory, if you don't mind my going into it, sure, for that story, which is called Last Stop on Route 9. That's one of the few stories in this collection that is literally about racism as the monster. I have subtle shades and incidents and comments that might imply racism in the other stories, but this is the one where racism is literally the monster. And the reason I did that was because, like many of these stories, I had editors reach out to me and say, hey, would you write me a short story by this date? And I often tend to procrastinate a little bit. So I get within about 3 weeks of when the story's due, and I'm like, oh, shoot, I'm supposed to be writing a story. I don't even have an idea. And the real life incident of getting lost on the road came to me. I wanted it to be a Gracetown story. So yes, it's a Gracetown story. I wanted there to be a child in it, but not just a child. I said, let me also go to that 20-something year old narrator. I don't do that often. But what I was really trying to do was reclaim that title, because I published a short story called Last Stop on Route 9 when I was in college at Northwestern University. Probably was my first college publication, you know, but it was an indication of how far away I had come from my own roots as a writer. I started writing little girls on spaceships. And by the time I got little Black girls, I should say, but by the time I got through college, after my exposure to canon, what a short story felt like to me was a white protagonist having an epiphany. Okay, so I wasn't writing horror and I wasn't writing Blackness. My story, Last Stop on Route 9, was literally about a white dude who goes to a gas station and we find out he's sick. And that's it. Last Stop on Route 9, get it? So I really wanted no shade to who I was as a young writer, but I really wanted to reclaim that title as an all-out racism is the monster, blackety black, horror out the wazoo. Okay.
Well, so I think you were pretty clear when you said she'll set dogs on anybody Negro.
And that again is based on real life when my mother and other college students in the 1960s were registering people to vote. They had farmers who would set their dogs on them. Okay. So, and trust me, I you can probably tell from this collection, I don't have much love for dogs. I'm working on it. I have a grand dog now. And Nala is an ambassador for all dogdom for me, because I have some either firsthand bad experiences or heard enough bad stories or seen enough bad photographs. German Shepherds in particular are not my favorite breed. So yeah, I just threw everything that is racial that has haunted me in that story. Getting lost, knocking on the wrong door, and wouldn't you know it, right after the collection comes out, you have this young man, Ralph Jarl, who 14 years old, shot, just knocking on a door. And also Renisha McBride, I mentioned her in the story, had happened previous to that. Just the hatefulness, you know what? Don't answer the door. Don't answer the door. You don't have to answer the door because someone knocks. This is the first thing that I think everyone needs to understand. I know this. I had someone ring my doorbell the other day. I peeked out. I didn't know them. I was busy. I ignored it. That's what you do. You don't shoot people.
Well, it feels like at times, you know, metaphorically speaking, that the Black community in the United States is living in a horror story.
Yes. Well, that is true. And I think that's why Black horror can be so effective, and why I think my late mother, Patricia Stevens Dew, really loved horror and nurtured it in me, gave me my first Stephen King novel, was very supportive of me after I discovered what I was supposed to be writing, is that whatever the real wounds are you're carrying, and for her, a lot of them were racial. A lot of them had to do with state violence against her when she was taking part in peaceful marches. She wore dark glasses almost her whole adult life because of sensitivity to tear gas and the aftermath of that tear gassing. So it resonates with her when there's a movie about zombies trying to break into your house. It resonates with her when it's a ghost story or a demon story, because it touches real fear for her life, real fear for her children and her family. We had death threats when we moved into an all-white neighborhood when I was young. So she would take that fear I didn't know this at the time. I've only figured this out in retrospect. She would take that fear and leech it out a bit by watching a horror movie where you can feel a sense of validation. Yes, this is what it feels like to be afraid. This looks like what I feel like. And give the monster a face, because often there is no one monster that you can try to fight or put a spell against. You know, it's more than that. It's systemic. It's so big. It's hard to focus on where should the first battles be. You know, I mean, there's so many battlefronts. So horror has a way of cutting through all that to just the emotion of fear and give you a cathartic ride. And then at the end of it, you're like, "Woo! Well, at least my life isn't as bad as what just happened in this story." And it, to me, it's not about whether the characters survive or not, although I do like to have hopefulness within my horror. I don't believe in unredemptive horror storytelling for the most part. I mean, I can think of one story that doesn't have necessarily that great redemptive ending. But to me, the point is not whether the characters survive or whether they win. The point is that moment they decide they're going to fight. Like, I didn't even know there were ghosts. I didn't even know there were demons. And I'm going to fight this. And that's how we all have to sort of walk in the world, because the things that are against us are big and we feel small, but we have to, you know, put on our big girl panties, as my aunt says, and step up.
Now, you do touch in the Last Stop on Route 9, you do touch on the notorious reformatory where Uncle Harry had spent 6 months. So was that sort of based on real life experience, as you mentioned earlier?
That was, you know, that was actually an homage to the novel that I was still trying to finish, I'm sure, at the time I wrote that story. But also the Dozier School, which does stand, even though it's closed now, kind of a ghost over Florida. People who are old men now still having nightmares about their time they spent at that horrible place. I only realized, though, recently when I was doing a reading that, dang, that place should have been shut down by the 1960s. You know, my novel is set in 1950. So I realized that if I say in Last Stop on Route 9 that it was still open in the 1960s, that's a fail right there. They should have shut that place down a lot sooner. In real life, it didn't get shut down until 2011.
So now I'm going to have to ask you about Colorado.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The Lodge, and whether or not you have a relative that was a famous actress in the past who inhabited roles that today we may not be so happy with.
You know, that part is fiction. That may be the most fictitious story in the whole collection, because while I have been to Colorado, no, I did not have a relative like that. My parents, my father's still living, but they're both civil rights activists. So it was the opposite of that. They Florida Civil Rights Hall of Fame, you know, both of them. So I felt like they were greatly respected. I guess that came out of my experiences of literally working in Hollywood. And since I started selling screenplays, I got my first credit in 2019 on Jordan Peele's Twilight Zone. Stephen Barnes, my husband and I, wrote an episode. That was my first TV credit. And since then, I've gotten a couple more on the horror noir, either anthology movie or series, depending on how they have it chopped up, on AMC Plus and Shudder. But working in Hollywood and seeing the barriers that exist even today and how hard people are fighting even today made me deeply curious about what other people went through in previous generations. So I started reading my Donald Bogle, my histories of Black Hollywood. And that's really where that story came from. Like, a woman who made the choices she had to make, because if you weren't playing a housekeeper, a servant, or the comic relief in the 1930s, you were not working. That's like literally all you had available to you. And she would have been like a Carol, like if you had like Charlie Chaplin, I guess. If Charlie Chaplin had been a Black woman, what kind of roles would Charlie Chaplin have gotten? So she's basically playing a maid called Lazy Maisie. And Lazy Maisie can do pratfalls like you cannot believe. She is a pure artist, but she's stuck in a time when the only way that artistry can manifest is through, you know, cooning, frankly, for lack of a better term. And it fell out of favor as time went on. Even Black people were like giving people the side eye, like, you know, you were helping to perpetuate the system and whatever. So all of her bitterness, all of her anger, she took with her to this mountain lodge that she created. Now that there's a little bit of truth in there, because I heard my mother say that on her stepfather's side of the family, they had a resort for Negroes, as they were called then, in Georgia. And jealous neighbors tried to shut it down. So I wanted to she created a safe space where her celebrity friends could come and be away from the world in the Colorado mountains. But she had a nervous breakdown. And while she was there by herself for 5 years, she developed a very odd relationship. And that's all to say. And she's also abusive, which I don't think is a spoiler, because that's another example of how, at least in my mind, I like to think that without the kind of pressure she was up against trying to survive in Hollywood, maybe she would not have been abusive. You know, I don't know for sure. It's not an excuse, but it's an explanation. But whatever it is, her stresses were such that she was abusive to her children and beyond, let's just say that. And all of it comes to a head in that story incident at Bear Creek Lodge, which, by the way, I've written a follow-up story called Return to Bear Creek Lodge, which will appear in another anthology. And I've almost decided that's my next novel, to be honest. I want to write a novel called Bear Creek Lodge, where I tell more of her story from her point of view back in the day. Something horrible she did we don't even know about yet. And then a contemporary story where the little boy, an incident at Bear Creek Lodge, takes his children back, not realizing that what happened on that story was not just his imagination.
Well, I'll just say that was maybe the character fictionally I disliked the most.
Which one? The grandmother?
The grandmother. She was so mean to
She's
her
mean.
Grandson.
Well, everybody has that. I didn't have a mean grandmother, but I know a lot of people have that mean grandmother.
Yeah, that was a,
she's fixated on, you know, presentation and ritual and children don't speak unless they're spoken to, that kind of old school upbringing. So worried about how she appears and what people think of her, you know. And yeah, she's mean. She's mean. And maybe she was born mean, or maybe Hollywood made her mean, or maybe it was a combination of those two things. But she is definitely mean.
So how do you put this collection of stories together? Did you start off with 20 or 30 different stories you were looking at and sort of besides the new stories you wrote and you started weaning them down? How did you put this collection together?
I might have had like two or three more stories that did not appear in this. And I had to write two. My editor at first wanted me to write three new stories, but Rumpus Room got so long that I convinced him that Rumpus Room was almost like two stories. So I only had to write two new stories. So the new stories are Rumpus Room and The Biographer, never before published. The Biographer, again, was reclaiming a story I tried to write as a younger writer. I had the premise, I had the title, but I don't think I had lived enough life to really fully understand what it means to have a biographer looking over your entire life. What do I know about a biographer when I'm in my early 20s? Now, the stories that did not make it in, and I think I might have inadvertently referred to them in the acknowledgments. I don't know. Someone said, where is this story? There were a couple stories that I would consider suspenseful, or what some people would call dark, but they did not have a supernatural or metaphysical element. And for that reason, my editor didn't think they fit in the collection. Just as for my previous collection, I had an erotica story, you know, that also just didn't fit. It just doesn't fit tonally. So there were only a couple stories I have that didn't get included. But honestly, now I only had about 10 solid stories, and then I had to write a couple more.
So talk a little bit about being a working writer, because from the outside, you know, someone may think, whoa, you write that book and you just work on that book only. But, you know, from all the conversations I have with writers, they're doing multiple projects. It's not just a project, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is a great example of me just realizing one day, I even tweeted it out, oh, I have enough new short stories for a collection. And it might have been a year later before I even started shopping it. You know, I mean, it was a sort of a, because I was just, I was going, I was trying to break into screenwriting, working on scripts and pitches, really almost more than scripts, trying to learn this game, and also fighting with this novel I was trying to write. The Reformatory took me 7 years to write, not just because it entailed a lot of research into the facility itself and the history of the facility. I wanted to pay homage as much as I could to real history, but tell it as a ghost story. Really the thing that held me up was the emotions of it. The emotions of being in 1950, first of all, because when I write, it's very immersive. I feel like I'm there. And to write about a child being locked up in 1950, that was grim. You know, it was really, really grim for me as the writer. So what I'm hoping is, I was juggling a lot of different projects. Sometimes I was hiding from the Reformatory, you know. If I was writing a short story, I wasn't working on my novel. So every story in here is a time I chose not to be working on my novel. Like every story was me saying, oh, okay, good. Here's something else I can do. So I don't have to think about my novel. I've never taken so long to write a novel. It was at least 7 years. And that was a case where COVID was actually very helpful because it was clarifying. Oh, especially the first year, like when we didn't know, when you couldn't get toilet paper, everybody was watching Tiger King, we had lost our minds. I thought I might die before I finish this book. And that felt real. So that really helped me get on a page quota. And if any of you are writers out there, quotas are helpful. They're not fun, but they're very helpful. So if it's 3 pages a day, 1 page a day, 5 to 7 pages a day, whatever pace for each project is different, come up with a schedule for yourself. Hold yourself accountable. I had a chart. I put it up on my wall. I could stare that zero in the face if I didn't do any writing the day before. And that really did help me a lot.
Lesson I want to close with is your experience of breaking into Hollywood. How was that experience trying to break into Hollywood and finally making that breakthrough?
It is a long, long road. You know, the Writers Guild, as we're speaking right now, is on strike. So that's yet another situation where for a lot of us who just got our foot in the door is shut. You know, even if we shut it, it's still shut. So it's Hollywood is not meant for marginalized folk to break into. Let me just say that right now. It is a very, very relationship-driven industry. Relationships meaning people you've worked with before, and that usually is not us. So for people who are strangers, like, you know, knocking on doors and coming from all kinds of fields, we're very, very fortunate that a lot of people have fought hard to open those opportunities for us. Especially in the wake of George Floyd's murder, Hollywood was really, really paying attention to Blackness for a couple minutes there. And they want the money that they get from casting Black and casting marginalized folk because we support it. We don't see ourselves that often. We're happy. We will support. Not every time. Sometimes you don't do enough marketing for us to hear about the project. But if we hear about it, very often we will support it. If you want that money, you have to have some authentic voices. Because what Hollywood would do was, Sleepy Hollow is a great example of this. And this was just written about in the book called Burn It Down about Hollywood. It's called Power, Complicity, and a Call for Change in Hollywood. The reason Sleepy Hollow imploded, in my view, in part, is because you had a series with a Black co-lead and the writer's room did not match that. And the leadership did not match that. And they didn't know what to do with that character. And that actress could feel that they didn't know what to do with that character. So, and you see this a lot in ensemble shows, the Black character in isolation, they have no family, they have no home life. They're the only, like the first season of Stranger Things, a little Black kid was the only one, we never met his family, right? That's just typical, that's typical. And that goes to the writer's room. So you can't just cast Black and feel like you've solved the problem. You have to also hire Black. You also have to bring in Black directors, Black writers, and other marginalized groups. I'm not saying it all has to be Black. So I was lucky enough to try to get into publishing in the wake of Terry McMillan, who had just taught publishing that Black books make money. I've been trying to write screenplays for 20 years, and I'm very lucky as a writer to have the IP, the intellectual property, so that I've had chances to try to write scripts for The Good House back in 2007, 2008. I've had chances to read scripts that other people were writing about My Soul to Keep earlier than that. But there was never enough momentum for any of that to catch fire. And I feel like even with the strike, I have a couple of projects in development I can't talk about because I literally believe in the jinx at this point. But I feel like I'm better positioned than ever to have real say in maybe the creation of a series based around one of my books. That would be incredible. But it has been a long road. And to be perfectly honest, if it hadn't been for the fact that I got in touch with Jordan Peele over Twitter and invited him to my class at UCLA when Get Out came out. And he lectured at my class at UCLA when Get Out. If it had not been for that relationship, because then I get to go pitch. Then a couple years later, I get a Twilight Zone episode. Writer's Room. I had my first Writer's Room earlier this year because of a relationship. I met the showrunner, Brian Fuller, when we were taping a horror special a few years ago. So it's a rough road. But the thing I say to writers is, especially if you write prose, like if you write books, Hollywood loves an adaptation. So the advice I got in college from a screenwriter, how do I break into Hollywood? He said, write novels. Now, I consider that the long way around because it's 20 plus years later, but there is some truth to it. There is some truth to it because even though it was almost 30 years before I got my first adaptation in horror noir, you know, Steve and I adapted his stories. The Lake was one I had written, and then Fugue State was one we wrote together. That was my first adaptation since I started publishing in 1995. But in that same special was a young lady who had only published a couple short stories, getting her first adaptation after a couple years. So publish. That would be my first advice. Publish your stories. A story can be adapted to a movie. A story can be adapted to a television episode of an anthology series. Publish your books. Learn screenwriting. If you don't have time to take a class or no, you know, then read scripts, read good scripts and watch the movie while you read the script to learn the difference between what you're seeing on the screen and what you're responsible for writing on the page, because they're not the same thing. You can't learn how to write screenplays by watching movies. You have to read scripts. But if you keep at it, who knows? Victor Laval has The Changeling coming out on Apple TV Plus, and he worked his way up so that he could be a part of that process. And it takes time, but we just got to keep pushing against those walls, keep knocking them down.
Well, Tanata Reeve, I really thoroughly was scared by The Wishing Pool and other stories.
Thank you so much.
I love it. It's because it's the variety is also very, very appealing. It's not just a type of horror. It's multiple ways from the plague to, you know, maybe a kind of an alternative history.
Trying to get you in every direction I can.
It really worked well. Author of The Wishing Pool and other stories, Tanata Reeve, thank you so much for being a guest on Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you so much. And if people want to keep in touch with me, just join my mailing list at TananaReeveList.com.
And your website is?
My website is TananaReeveDo.com. And I also have a podcast I'll shout out that I do with my husband called Life Writing, Write for Your Life. That's on Realm Media. That's just
WWW. You said that was marriage advice? I'm joking.
No. Well, I mean, sometimes, but we mostly talk about craft and interview writers and screenwriters and comics.
Right. You know. No, yeah, because that actually, I was going to ask the question, are you going to give any advice about writing with your spouse, with your partner?
Do it very carefully.
Thank you.
You know,
so
the biggest piece of advice is in any collaboration, someone has to have the final say. Otherwise, you're just going to go around and around and around in circles. Someone has to have the final say.
Got
to
have 5149.
Exactly.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.